Lord, empty us of self and fill us with you. So the alerting tones went off, right? Anybody remember Squad 51 emergency, right? Kind of that squawking tone, which we use for a long time. We can talk about that. There's a whole different sort of methodology to waking first responders up these days. But this was before we'd done that in Virginia Beach. And this horrible jangling tone goes off, and I wake up in a room filled with red light, which was a companion to the tones. These red lights come on. I sort of spun on the bed and kind of paused and rested my arms on my knees just for a moment, kind of long enough just to take a deep breath and kind of get my surroundings. Hang on a second. Is that better? A little less squeal?
Yeah.
Yes, okay. Sorry about that. It's hard to find good help these days. So the tones were dying. The light is glowing. I look up at the clock on the wall, big digital clock. It's 5:17 in the morning. I'm reaching for my boots, and it begins. Rescue 1, 122R, Engine 1, Zone 8, Zone 2, EMS 5, cardiac arrest. They give the address. I remember the address, but I'll keep it out of the talk because it's a real person's address. They say PD is en route as well, 0518. So I started to move a little more quickly as the dispatcher's voice trailed off, and I shouted across the room to my partner, "Hey, Brant, hear that?" "Yeah." And I can hear him rustling across the other side of the room. So to clarify, cardiac arrest is bad, right? The heart has stopped. It could be caused by a number of things, but generally this would be a condition we would consider incompatible with life. It's my first cardiac arrest. Now, how many of you have taken CPR? Anybody in the room, right? So lots of you have taken CPR. That's a great thing. If you haven't done it in a long time, go get recertified. It makes a difference. But this is what we plan for. This is what we prepare for. You know, I guess I would insert here that you've probably heard people in emergency medicine, people in a lot of fields, but I think certainly in firework, in EMS, we have to have sort of a warped sense of humor, right? Everybody's heard the expression, if we don't laugh, we'll cry, that kind of thing. And so we have jokes, we talk about things, and rather dismissively, in some of the most complex, painful emergency situations in the world, we reduce to these, you know, silly sayings and silly jokes. And what this is a classic somebody waking up dead, right? It's not that people die at 5 in the morning or 6 in the morning or 7 in the morning, but lots and lots of people get found at 5 in the morning, at 6 in the morning, at 7 in the morning. And so it's this concept of waking up dead. So that's where we are. This is my very first cardiac arrest. I've trained for this. I've prepared for this. I've been taking CPR since the eighth grade, I think, was the first time I took CPR. But I've never used it. So Brant and I are now moving very quickly towards our ambulance. The patient's address is very close by, almost literally across the street from the station, maybe 4 or 5 blocks away. He jumps in to drive, and I mark us on the call on the computer. We all have a little computer to tell dispatch we're en route, we're on our way. I pull up the case notes. 87-year-old male found by daughter in bed, not breathing, not responsive. CPR is not in progress. As I'm reading, Brant flips on the lights and kind of bumps the siren. It's weird, you know, the law says that whenever your lights are on, your siren is supposed to be on, but my rescue squad, we're in the middle of this residential area, and it's 5 o'clock in the morning, and, you know, we find that we don't want to kind of come out, sirens blazing, so he gives it sort of just a little bump. We got a little manual button. It's almost just kind of like a horn, just a kind of a whoop, whoop. There's no traffic on the street. So the road in front of our bay is empty, and we pull out, and we turn into the road, and he's heading towards the destination. So at this point, and probably several steps before this, I catch myself praying. I'm praying for myself. So here's the thing. Cardiac arrest seems very scary on the surface. But the reality is there's nothing I can do as a provider to make it worse, right? It's almost one of those things where you're a little bit off the hook, right? Because at this moment, for all intents and purposes, my patient is dead. Maybe mostly dead, but dead. And there are lots of things I can do to help. There are lots of things we train on and practice, and we try to make it better. But the simple fact of the matter is, I honestly can't make it worse. I can't make the guy more dead. But that's not what we think about in those moments, right? It's this sort of consuming process, and I'm scared. I'm terrified, right? This is the real thing. This is not a drill. This is not practice. This is not Annie, are you all right? This is not a little plastic mannequin, right? This is a human being, right? In my neighborhood, my neighbor, right? We like to use that word, right? This is my neighbor. But he's dead, and I'm going to go try to help, and I'm praying. And I think you all know this prayer. This is that, God, don't let me screw this up. Prayer, right? Does everybody have some version of that? Oh, yeah. Right? The just that begging, just don't let me screw this up. And I feel it just almost as this chant running through my system and running through my blood, and just, oh God, please don't let me screw this up. Please don't let me screw this up. Begging. I just want to be part of the solution, right? I just want to help. So I talked about kind of all of the units that were going. One of the things that I think in most EMS systems, certainly in Virginia Beach, when there's a cardiac arrest, we respond with a lot of people. So at this moment in time, there are some 14 or 15 individuals and probably nearly $3 million worth of equipment rolling towards this individual's house. We have a fire engine going with four firefighters who are also EMTs. We have Brant and myself in an ambulance. We have police on the way. We have two zone medics that are, quick lesson, there are different levels. We talked about ALS and BLS yesterday, right? Basic life support, advanced life support. You have sort of your garden variety basic EMT, and we move through that paradigm up to paramedic. Just to give you some place that you can latch into this, EMT is about a semester long. That was about a 13-week class that I took to become an EMT. Paramedic is essentially an associate's degree. It's about 2 years of training, much higher levels of pharmacology and medicines and interventions. I can't start an IV. You start getting into ALS, they can get intravenous access, they can push drugs, they can do a lot of things. And in the city of Virginia Beach, the way our system is set up, most of our ambulances, not all, but most of our ambulances are BLS ambulances. They're people like me. They're volunteers. We have almost 700 people that volunteer in the city of Virginia Beach to do this. And then we have about 40 paid professional zone medics. And they're not in ambulances. They come in cars, or more specifically, SUVs, these Tahoes. And so for cardiac arrest, we have two of them en route. So we have two zone medics, fire engine, we have the police, because if the police can beat us, they're all trained in CPR. They can actually start things going. And then a street supervisor, right, which is somebody there to come take command of the scene and control everything that's going on. So right now, at this moment, all of us are set to converge at this patient's house. And so I'm praying, I'm begging, and we get there just as the fire engine arrives. They tend to move a little bit faster. They're pretty gung-ho. So they're getting out of their truck, and they're grabbing equipment. I mark us on scene, right, in the computer, and I jump out of the truck, and Brant's getting out on the other side. And we've done this dozens of times, right? There's a whole specific drill for this, because there's this whole list of things that you need. And we want them in the house with the patient, right? So we routinely, especially in a cardiac arrest, take way more equipment than we need, because what don't you want? You don't want to be, oh, I need this. Oh, it's 300 yards that way in the truck. I'll be right back, right? This is true. I mean, most of the calls that we go on aren't life and death, right? You know, we do a lot of grandma stubbed her toe kind of calls that, you know, people call 911. But this, when this is going on, we want to be there with everything that we need. So it's this whole list of things, right? It's a backboard and straps and a C collar and it's our suction machine and an IV box and a drug box. And we've practiced dozens of times getting all of this stuff out and the way you place it on the stretcher so that you can then deploy things back off the stretcher and get to them quickly. And so at this point, that's kind of kicking in, right? I'm grabbing stuff and we're stacking stuff on the stretcher. And I look up and it's this small house, this little brick ranch house on a raised foundation. So it's about kind of three steps up the stoop to go up into the house. And so we turn the corner around the ambulance and we're sort of nose to tail with these four firefighters with their equipment. We're all kind of trotting our way up to the door. We get there and we decide we're not going to carry the stretcher in. Some of these other people have started to arrive, and now this is kind of this small mob scene. There are people everywhere. Neighbors are coming out because now they have, you know, a fire engine and lights and noise and commotion at 5:25 in the morning. Neighbors are popping by, asking questions. Don't ever do that, by the way. Well, if you have something actual, practical, and useful to add to the conversation, two thumbs up. Come be that person. But don't be the, hey, what's going on? What's wrong with Fred? Stop. Don't do that. Public service announcement. So it's a small house, this little brick house. And we park the stretcher. I kind of kick the foot brake. I grab my suction machine. I slide my backboard out from under. I've got a bag of straps. I got my suction machine. I got my backboard. So when I say backboard, you guys know what I mean, right? It's like this long piece of, they're plastic now. They used to be wood, but you see them at the pool a lot. Well, they're not easy to walk with, right? You get a lot of those, like you've seen the hay mow bit with the 2x4 where you're kind of ducking and swinging and dipping, and that's what it is. It's this big 6 foot long, 2.5 foot wide piece of plastic. So I've kind of got that under my arm and I got my stuff. And I'm racing up the stoop towards this patient behind the firefighters. And so this is one of those things that, normally, right, we're processing visual data at about 30 frames per second. In moments of stress, that can ratchet up to 120 frames per second, right? And that's what causes, anybody been in a situation like maybe you're in a car accident, you're doing something, you're falling down the steps, and you feel like time slows down? It's just like this wah, 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 right? But that's what's going on. You're getting, 3 to 4 times the visual data that your brain normally gets. And so it's about this time that I'm realizing that that's happening, right? Time is slowing down, and I'm not scared anymore, right? This fear has diminished, right? And I have this air of confidence. I don't know, maybe it was the backboard. I just felt like, I was invincible. I got the backboard. We're cool. So maybe it was false confidence, perhaps. And I think, the adrenaline's kicking in now, right? You're getting that supercharge. And now people are everywhere. I counted afterwards. We had 14 medical people and firefighters on scene and their family members. And now the neighbors are coming into the house asking questions. But we kind of weave through the crowd and we make this hard right into a hallway and then an immediate hard right into the patient's bedroom. And so just as I'm walking in, here's sort of the scene in front of me. One of the firefighters is at his feet, and he grabs all of the top bed clothes, and he pulls everything off. And here's this 87-year-old man, as naked as the day he came into the world. And the other, another firefighter is at the top checking for a pulse. It didn't take a lot to just look at this patient and see that he was not doing well. And so they grab his shoulders and his feet, two different firefighters, and they start to pick him up. And it was kind of, I don't want to say it was fun. That's not the right word, but it struck me, even in real time, because as I'm watching them sort of swing this patient off the bed, I'd like get to my knees and slide the backboard. Remember my backboard? Slide my backboard right up under the patient. It was like we'd done it a million times. And it just had this very fluid motion, right? But there I am, on my knees. And as swiftly as the confidence came, now is the, kind of the first time I get to look at the patient. And every bit of confidence evaporated. Now, I'm still doing things, and the world is still moving slowly. And at this point, I'm helping secure the patient to the backboard. Firefighters have started CPR. CPR is now in process. The patient was warm, but that was about the best thing you could say for him. He was very gray, very ashen. It's one of the things they talk about when you go through class. We use all of these words, but you don't really know it until you see it. It's something, anybody kind of familiar with the concept of moulage, where we make up patients and make them look hurt. But I don't care how much moulage you've seen or how many pictures you've seen on the YouTube, seeing the dead guy, you're very, very struck by it. Just that color, this very deep ashen gray color. He's got a little vomitus at his mouth, that's visible, and it's clear that he's not doing well. And so I'm helping to sort of secure him, and we're starting to get this patient. And I'm not thinking, but there's this moment where I start this prayer cycle again, and I'm struck, kind of like that I should have had a V8 kind of smack in the head. Why are you praying for you? It was like this voice that I heard, like, why are you praying for you? And so I have this whole argument kind of in felt like minutes, but it's just a few frames back and forth, where I thought, well, my God, what do I pray for? What do I pray for? I knew this guy was in bad shape, and I'm running through things, am I praying for him? Am I praying for healing? Am I, is this Lazarus, get up and come out? What am I praying for? Am I praying for the family? By now, I can hear somebody, and I don't know who it is, kind of sniffling, crying. You know what I mean? It was more of a sob. It wasn't this horrible, moaning or wailing, but I can clearly hear somebody upset behind us. And so I kind of track on that for a second. I think, well, should I pray for them? And I'm running through this. And without question, it was one of the times for me that I understood that this is what it means to pray for God's will. Right? This is that fork in the road. This is that turning point. I can't solve this. Right? I said in my prayer group yesterday, I'm a fixer. Right? I'm a mover, I'm a shaker, I like to do things, I like to be the boss. I like to be in charge of things, I like that to rest with me. I told you yesterday, and it's true, I never was an athlete, but if I were an athlete, I'd want to be the guy that takes the last shot. I'm comfortable with that, I like it. And there on my knees, in front of this patient, it was just this sort of epiphany, this, well, dude, this is about God's will. right? And again, I'm telling it way longer than it took. But in that flash, the 9 o'clock prayer came to me, right? And so I answered myself, you know, should you be praying for you? No. And I started to track the 9 o'clock prayer, right? And it just kind of over and over in my head, and I'm communicating, I'm talking to these firefighters, I'm talking to police officers, there's all of this scene going on, and in my head is just this, thy will be done, over and over and over again. Because the deeper we get into this, the more likely it is becoming that this is not going to be a good patient outcome from a medical perspective, right? We can talk about where has he gone and is this a bad thing for the patient? I'd like to believe not. But if we're keeping score by, you know, how many we convert or how many we save, this was not going to be a win for the good guys. This patient was at this point deceased. And we were starting to get a quick feeling for that. I said he was still warm, but not real warm. He'd probably been down for easily over an hour before they came in and found him in the morning. So you start to get to this place where even if we get this patient, get his heart going again, you know, what about his brain? And is there, you know, and so we're already sort of having the, you know, well, he's 87, he's lived a good life, and we're already kind of starting to have those rationalizations, and the police chaplain has showed up, but we're still what we would, you know, the way we would describe it is we're still working the code, right? We're still working this patient. They've intubated him, so they've put a tube down his throat to help him breathe, so we can manually ventilate him, right? If I say bag valve mask, does that mean something to everybody? It's the thing you see on TV where they're always coming into the ER on the TV shows, you know, pumping the bag. It's that thing. So they've got him intubated. The medics are there. We're starting to get IV access. Meanwhile, Brandt and somebody else behind me have brought the stretcher into the room, and we're picking our patient up, and we're going to take him in. And still, this prayer is flowing through me. And it was the first time that conceptually I started to tie this together with this order to pray without ceasing, right? We talked a little bit about it last night, that I've tried everything and it's not working, now I'm going to pray, right? And I've longed for that prayer without ceasing, right? That prayer is breath. And what I began to feel was this prayer from my core. Right? So one of my favorite words, and I overuse it, but I think maybe I've overused it just in getting to this point to use it, I think, properly. So we talk about the visceral organs, right? Our viscera, right? Kind of these organs deep in your abdomen, and that's evolved into this visceral kind of process, right? When something's visceral, you feel it in your gut. Right, it is relating to deep inward feelings more than it is relating to the intellect. And so I kind of, even through this whole process of working this patient, I'm beginning to feel this heartbeat of prayer within me, and this very, very visceral prayer. And it begins to kind of take a life of its own. And so we get the patient in the back of the ambulance, and we get the right people in there, and it's interesting. And I feel blessed because just in my, I've been an EMT a little less than 5 years. And in that time, we've watched some very interesting developments. And there are a couple of machines that do this, but in Virginia Beach, we use a machine that's called a Lucas device. And basically what it is, it's a compression robot, right? So we strap it to the patient, and it does compressions. And it will run on one battery 45 minutes, and it will do perfect compressions at exactly the right depth. It's a little creepy. There are stories of people being revived while this is on their chest, and as soon as it gets turned off, they go back. Right? So it's this machine that it's mechanical. Right? And they're literally EMTs coming out of classes now that may never have to do chest compressions. Especially as we deploy more and more of these, because it's relatively speaking, relative to most medical equipment, it's very affordable. I say that it's about a $15,000 piece of equipment. I don't think I've ever bought a car that costs more than $15,000. But if you want to have that conversation, my ambulance is about $500,000 worth of truck and stuff. It's about $255,000 just for the truck. I've referenced now several times that stretcher. That stretcher's $18,000, the life pack, which is the leads, the heart monitor, and the AED, $28,000, all of these things. So in the grand scheme of things, to my warped sense of economics, $15,000 for this machine that can do perfect chest compressions is pretty reasonable. So that's a whole thing, and this whole, the other thing that has changed a lot, if we went and worked that same code today, we probably wouldn't have left with the patient. We are making more decisions on scene now, rather than trying to package all of that up. We feel that our efforts are better spent there on a hard surface in somebody's bedroom than bumping down the road in the back of an ambulance, and we can stay there for 20 minutes or half an hour or 40 minutes, and we can make the decision right there that no, this, we're going to stop working this. This patient is deceased. But this was still sort of under the old protocols, and you can imagine, an ambulance is a pretty confined space, right? And so we've got this stretcher in, we've got a medic that's at the head of the bed. And then Brandt is on one side of the patient, and I'm on the other side of the patient. And anybody from your, there's going to be a quiz. Any of you CPR people, how long do you do CPR? About 2 minutes. I'm not going to put you on the spot, right? It's about a two-minute cycle because you get tired because it's hard work. And even if you don't feel like you're not doing as good a job, after it's about 2 minutes of good compressions, you're not doing as good a job. So Brandt is on one side of the patient, I'm on the other, and we're taking turns. We're going back and forth, counting each other off, doing compressions. There's a metronome going, right, to the beat of Staying Alive. Everybody knows that, right? You've had your 100 to 120 beats per minute. And so we're going back and forth doing compressions. And when we're not doing compressions, we're ventilating the patient. Now, ventilating the patient's kind of awful. I would rather be doing compressions. And the problem with ventilating the patient is you have to keep yourself in check. So anybody had a job where you watched a TV show about your job and you just went, ay, 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 not even close, right? And I would suggest to you that's true about any job. But one of the first things you'll notice if you get into, pre-hospital care, emergency medicine, is, we talked about the BVM, right? We've got this bag. And when you are seeing it on TV, they're barreling into the ER just crushing that thing, right? Because that's drama. Look at them go, right? They're going to save this guy come hell or high water. Squeeze it, right? In reality, we're ventilating that patient about 10 times a minute, right? So what we're doing is we're delivering a ventilation, right? We never squeeze it. We're delivering a ventilation over a second, and then we're counting. 1,000, 2,000, 3,000, 4,000, 5,000, ventilate. 1,000, 2,000, 3,000. So you're already bored, right? This doesn't make good TV. but that's how we do it. And that's hard, right? It's very, when you practice, when you're sitting in class, it's very easy to sort of just kind of chill and get that rhythm and ventilate. But, with this guy dying in front of you, we don't count. We don't lose track. And so, I don't know, this was be on the internet. I don't know if I should say his name, but we had an older, very surly medic. that was at the head of the bed, whom I adore. He's a super great guy, and he's not on my short list of medics I would send away if they came to save me, right? There's some people in Virginia Beach I might be like, you know what, never mind. I'll go POV, which is scary enough in its own right. But he's not that guy. He's a great medic. But I'm taking my turn ventilating, right? And I think he swore at me. So I promised I wouldn't swear from the podium, but he basically told me to slow down my ventilations, that I was going to hyperventilate the patient in a less polite way. And so, okay, which is cool. You know, I'm thick-skinned. Didn't bother me. So I'm ventilating, and I'm counting it off in my head, and I realize, thy kingdom come, thy will be done, on earth as it is in heaven, is just about the right meter, right? It's just about the right pace. So there I am, ventilating this patient. And I am imagining the breath that I'm putting into this gentleman as the breath of Jesus, as the breath of the Lord. And with every ventilation, between every ventilation, I've got this prayer just cycled through my head. And again, the word's starting to pick up pace, right? That kind of this has become less of an emergency, more typical. Now we're driving in the ambulance and doing the things we do there, and they're pushing drugs, and our patient's not getting better, right? Which is not fun, but I'm starting to feel sort of this peace with it and this sense of it that okay, it's okay. Right, and it's like I said, you know, he's 87. This is because I'll tell you, right? And we all want to believe, just like we're parents, we're not going to have favorite kids. We're treating everybody the same, and we want to believe that all medical care is impartial. But I will tell you, the way we treat a 3-year-old in respiratory arrest is completely different than the way we treat an 87-year-old in cardiac arrest. Right? There's a whole different level. Right? A whole different impression of just the stress, the way it presents. So this is the farther we go, and this is just again to give you some perspective, probably a 12 minute ride to the ED, to the emergency room. And so we're riding along and going back and forth, and we pull in. We get it down. We get everything kind of in. One of the nice things in this type of scene is at that point, most of my responsibility as a BLS provider is kind of over. We've turned this patient over to the nursing staff at Sentara Virginia Beach General Hospital, and for the first time, I sort of get to breathe. So. Backing up a little bit, here's a piece of the story, right? We talked about now we make those decisions on scene much more often than we used to. One of the things you need to know, I don't put dead people into my ambulance. So if you have been declared deceased, I don't want it to sound this way, but that's not my problem, right? Now the medical examiner's coming and police handle all of that. That's not a function of emergency medical services. That's a function of the police department. It's now a death investigation, right? No matter how you may have died, whether it's at your own hand or natural causes, or it is officially a death investigation, and police is dealing with the body. So if we're not working that patient, if we don't think that there's some potential for a positive medical outcome, we pack up and go, and police are there to handle it. And so here I am, and I'm at the hospital. We're starting to clean stuff up. And this little police officer sort of totters over to me. And I don't remember him from the scene. I knew there were a lot of people there, but I was, of single purpose, single mind. And he comes over, and he's like, man, I'm sure glad you worked him. I didn't want to stay there. That was the worst smell I've ever smelled in my life. So I'm processing it back in my head. And the first thing I note is I didn't smell anything, right? And I have sort of a hyper-gag reflex. I'm not good with odors in general, and I'm a sympathetic retcher, you know? If you're vomiting, well, thanks for laughing at one of my deepest seated issues. But when I was going, I mean, it was a real thing, you know. When I was going into EMS, I thought, you know, I don't have a big problem with blood. I'm not a fan of poop. I don't, but I can deal with it. But I was like, how am I going to deal with the vomit? Right? Because I'm sitting on this little chair, and there's, you know, people with their emesis bag, you know, 16 inches from me. So that was a milestone, you know, the first time, you know, represent. The first time I had somebody, you know, vomiting 16 inches from me, and I survived the call, I was happy. But it was very striking to me that I had not noticed any aroma or scent, or that I was just able to shut that down. That even in this slowed down time space, it was amazing to me that I left there. And you know, and this is for a seasoned police officer to describe as the worst scene he's ever smelled. It's like, ah, that's interesting, right? Then immediately struck by, you know, how callous this guy was. Like, you know, here's somebody's father, grandfather, great uncle just passed away, and all you're happy about is that you didn't have to stay there and do paperwork in the, you know, in the smelly house. It's like, okay. I walked back away from it, though, you know, and there's a lot of cleaning in EMS. If you don't like to make beds, if you don't like to wipe things down, don't get involved with pre-hospital care. We clean up a lot. And so we're cleaning. We're wiping. You know, you get sort of the wax on, wax off, kind of going down your cot, going down your stretcher. And it's just beginning to hit me what I've done, what I've been through, right? And you can't have many repeat first times. And so I'm trying to kind of process this and save it and figure out how I feel about it. And I know that it wasn't my fault. I know he was dead when we got there. I know he'd been dead. I never heard real numbers, but I suspect he'd been dead at least an hour before anybody even noticed him. He was a goner, right? Short of absolute miracle, this gentleman was not ever going to come back out of that bedroom again. And it just touched me in a way that I have a hard time explaining. The process that I went through was so fast. And it was funny. The commander on the scene, the EMS commander on the scene, came to the hospital, and he came down to the EMS room. We've got a little, I guess it's like a little clubhouse, you know. We hang out and do paperwork and drink a little. They have the little baby cans of soda, you know. We can drink them, and we're hanging out in the EMS room. And he comes in. And he doesn't know, right? He doesn't know this is my first cardiac arrest. He has no idea, because we don't talk about that. It's not, you know, hey. I've since gone back and told him, but he came in and he kind of touched my shoulder, and it's that we've talked about it here before. I think it's kind of as Barbara Thomas talks about that, you know, sometimes just that touch can feel like a hug, right? That enveloping touch, and he just touched my shoulder, And he said, "Hey, I just want to make sure you guys are all right." And I looked at him. I said, "Oh, yes, sir. Cool. Two thumbs up." He said, "Well, I'm gonna go clean your truck." Okay, thank you. Right? Because the truck is a mess, right? Supplies, stuff thrown everywhere. Thank you, sir. And we went back, parked the truck. Our shift ends at 6 a.m. We work 6 at night, or mostly I work nights because I have a day job. Generally one shift a week, 12 hours from 6 p.m. to 6 a.m. And so it's now a little past probably 6:30, probably been an hour of time to make all this happen. And we roll back to the station, and I don't think we said a word. And still, the 9 o'clock prayer is just rolling through me. And we get back and park the truck, and I go home. I changed my clothes, or at that point I kind of got into my pajamas and took a little nap before I went to work. And for me, it was my first cardiac arrest, but it was the beginning of this process of understanding visceral prayer, of being one step closer to prayer without ceasing. It's funny. We have this very strange place in EMS where it's, you don't want people to get hurt, but if they're going to get hurt anyway, at least do it when I'm on shift so I get to do cool things, right? It's kind of, it relates to that weird sense of humor. And I'm not saying there's not nights that you definitely don't want to go in and just be like, you know, I just want to sleep tonight. You know, I'm fine if we don't turn a wheel on this truck. But you're not attracted to this process, to this lifestyle, to this contribution, to this type of service without wanting some of that action. And it was one of the first nights one of the first shifts where I was where the action was. And I wish I could have done more, but I'm very thankful for the change in me that took place that day. And we'll always appreciate the sacrifice that he made for me that day, that morning. And that's the story of my first cardiac arrest. Lord, empty us of self and fill us with you. Amen.